Hello, and welcome to Primary Sources, a featured production of Radio CALS. Here on Primary Sources, we focus on people who are making a difference in Little Rock and Arkansas. Some you might have heard of, and some you haven't heard of, but probably want to know about. Check out cals.org/podcasts for a free podcast of Primary Sources interviews.
Hi, this is David Strickland. I'm the director of the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies, and I'm here to welcome to this episode of Primary Sources, Ken Barnes. Kenneth C. Barnes is a professor of history at the University of Central Arkansas and the 2017 winner of the Booker Worthen Literary Prize for a book we'll be talking about in this episode. I'm very pleased to have you here as my guest.
Thank you, David.
Yeah, thanks. And I want to talk, before we talk about the book, Anti-Catholicism in Arkansas, I want to get you to talk a little bit about yourself, where you grew up and where you went to school.
Okay. I'm a native of Arkansas and grew up here. Went to school at Clinton, lived out in the country in a farm. My early life was spent in Arkansas. After high school, went off to college at UCA, where I'm now teaching. And then after I graduated there, I left Arkansas for 15 years. Spent some time in graduate school in England, the University of East Anglia, and then did my PhD at Duke University and taught for 9 years in the Chicago area, 1 year in Mississippi, and then ended up coming back home to Conway and to UCA.
Hmm. Let's talk about this book for the Booker Worthen Prize winner. Anti-Catholicism in Arkansas, How Politicians, the Press, the Klan, and Religious Leaders Imagined an Enemy, 1910 to 1960. And talk about just what's your kind of overview description of the book, and then we'll talk about some things about it.
Right. You know, basically, I was just trying to get at this sort of the last big wave of anti-Catholicism in American history. Anti-Catholicism has come and gone, sort of waxed and waned from the very beginning, from colonial days, and has had its moments in the 1800s when it kind of rose to a hot point. But the last sort of really strident wave of anti-Catholicism was in the early 1900s, the 19-teens and to the 20s. And I think probably at that time it was most expressed viciously in the South and the Midwest. So Arkansas would be sort of like a prototype of a good place to study anti-Catholicism in that period. And of course, it's what was interesting to me since I lived here. I'd say for me, partly it's personal because I grew up in rural Arkansas in the 1960s and my parents held some prejudices against Catholics that I heard growing up. When I was in high school, my older brother converted to Catholicism. And in my childhood, it's just one of the conversations I remember around the kitchen table was somewhat heated arguments about Roman Catholics. And so in my later life, after my parents were gone, I explored that subject in some ways just to understand my own background a little bit better, but found lots of really rich material to study here in Arkansas.
Talk a little bit about you mentioned, of course, the Know-Nothing movement briefly in the book, and talk a bit more about the 19th century as kind of the forerunner of what your book really is
about.
In
the 1850s, there was a very well-organized expression of anti-Catholicism, but it more was in evidence in the Northeast, in northern cities, where, let's say, Irish immigrants were coming in. And then it died out a bit, but by the 1890s, it came back again, and again was more in evidence in the North than it was in the South. But this last expression in the teens especially seemed to be strong in the American South, and leading into the 1920s when that gets subsumed into the Ku Klux Klan, which, of course, had its origins in Georgia and was very strong in Arkansas and elsewhere in the South, but really all over the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk about, I'm especially interested in the word imagined.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really important word for your book. But let's talk first about some of the manifestations of that.
Okay.
Some people will be shocked to discover there was a chapter of the Ku Klux Klan at Hendricks College,
right.
For instance.
Yes. There were several things I think that were a bit shocking, that were shocking to me when I found them. And one was one of the first manifestations of anti-Catholicism that sort of gets organized and leaves a paper trail in Arkansas in the 19-teens was a bill introduced in the legislature in 1913 that failed but was reintroduced in 1915 called the Convent Inspection Bill, and it required a sheriff in a county that had a convent to do an annual inspection of the convent to make sure that women, nuns, or maybe like schoolgirls weren't being kept there as sex slaves of priests. So there was this paranoia about Roman Catholic priests as being sexual predators. And there was a very kind of heavy sexual element to the rhetoric of the teens. Arkansas actually became the first state in the country to have a convent inspection law. There would be three other states that followed us. Nice to be first with something, but maybe not that. But Georgia, Alabama, and Florida also passed a convent inspection law shortly after Arkansas.
Mm-hmm. There was also some relation to the temperance movement, and which was very powerful.
Right.
So talk about that a little.
Yeah, by the later teens, some of that kind of sexual energy of the anti-Catholic movement had gone away when they did some of the first inspections, and the county sheriffs have nothing to find. It sort of like burst a bubble, and other issues kind of came to the fore. Like in the later teens, when prohibition was all the rage in Arkansas. Arkansas became dry a couple of years before we had national prohibition. So it was much discussed in the later years of the teens. Some people associated liquor with Catholics, and I think for good reason, that culturally, Catholics did not see anything wrong with consuming alcohol. But that became a sort of a way to revive anti-Catholicism, the Anti-Saloon League and the Women's Christian Temperance Union. Sort of became in their pro-prohibition sentiments also anti-Catholic. Also, by the later teens, when the U.S. went to war against Germany, I think that gave a bit of shot in the arm to anti-Catholicism because a lot of the Catholics in Arkansas spoke German. And some of them would say, well, we weren't really German, we're Swiss. But of course, not everybody would really pay attention to that. So I think there was some anti-Catholicism that rose in 1917 when we were at war with Germany.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit more about the Klan.
Right. There actually were three Klans. The original Klan was right after the Civil War during the Reconstruction period that was really all about trying to keep black men from voting or registering to vote. But that had been put to rest in Arkansas very effectively by military action by the governor, Reconstruction governor of Arkansas, Powell Clayton. So it really wasn't a Klan until it was revived in the 19-teens and then just mushroomed in the 1920s. It was born in rebirthed in 1915, but really took off in a big way about 1920, 21. Gets to Arkansas in 1921, but between 1921 and 23, it just was growing by leaps and bounds all throughout the state. I ended up counting at least 150 chapters of the Klan in Arkansas, chapters that had an actual charter, because they numbered them consecutively, with Little Rock being number one because it was the first. And so I know there was at least 140 because Corning, Arkansas, was Klan number 140. There may have been more that I just haven't seen identified. So it was just all over the state in small towns and large towns.
And the first Klan, to a great extent, was a terrorist organization.
Right.
And the second Klan, though, was a lot more respectable.
It certainly was.
Talk about that a little bit.
There were some cases of violence in Arkansas and in other states, but the Klan in the 1920s was more like a men's club, more like the Elks or the Lions Club or the Rotary. It was more dominated by prosperous community leaders. It had a lot of respect from people in the community or certain people in the community, and most of the time, as far as I can tell, didn't engage in a lot of violence, and a lot of the violence didn't really, what violence there was rarely was directed towards people of color. The cases I found, I've seen more evidence of, were directed towards moonshiners, bootleggers, houses of prostitution, sort of moral offenses, than they were against people of color or even Catholics. A lot of the rhetoric of the Klan in the 1920s was anti-Catholic, but I didn't find really many cases of actual violence.
And you talk a good bit about the role of fundamentalist preachers.
Yeah.
And say a bit about that. The fundamentalists were, of course, anti-modernists. They were trying
Certainly.
To put that genie back in the bottle. Is that what animates a lot of this Klan activity in the teens and 20s?
There were connections with the Klan and anti-Catholicism to especially Baptist churches, more so than, let's say, Episcopal, Catholic. Methodists were a little bit on the fence on this. There were quite a number of Methodists in the Klan, but I just didn't see as much anti-Catholic rhetoric coming out of Methodist clergy. I had read the state weekly newspapers that the church bodies published, and the Baptist papers were a treasure trove of Catholic anti-Catholic material. And, of course, some of those Baptist leaders were also in the Klan. One, probably the most dramatic, maybe charismatic personality of the 1920s, in the Baptist community and in the Klan community, was this missionary Baptist preacher here in Little Rock named Ben Bogard. And he flaunted his Klan membership and would even travel around the state giving lectures about the Klan, wrote a pamphlet entitled "The Ku Klux Klan Exposed," but exposed in his teaching in a positive way, and talked about, you know, the enemies of the Klan, of chief of which was the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah. And the preaching, I'm fascinated by what you say about the ministers, particularly this. There's a certain amount of mental gymnastics you have to do in light of the fact that Catholics kept Christian faith alive for a millennium and a half before Protestants came along. Was there an intellectual appeal to you? I mean, you talked about you wanted to do this partly to understand your upbringing, your parents' feelings and things, but also as a scholar, you have the opportunity to get into the heads of people who are proposing this. Was that the intellectual dimensions of it, the theological?
Well, actually, they had a very well-argued case for why they would believe, you know, what they believe in Bogart. You know, I had great admiration for his intellect. He was a genius, really. I admire what he was able to write, how much he knew, and how productive he could be. He was in the Ripley's Believe It or Not back in the 40s for preaching every Sunday over like a 50-year period and never missing once for illness. So he's a remarkable person, and he very well argued a theological basis for his anti-Catholicism. So it wasn't just like simple prejudice or nativism. He believed that Baptists were the original Christians and that Catholicism had taken Christianity off track for 1,000 years, and that there were certain persecuted minority groups all throughout that 1,000-year period who were keeping the true faith until Martin Luther and then others that would follow him that would take things more in a Baptist direction would restore the purity of Christianity. So it wasn't just a knee-jerk kind of simple prejudice. It was a pretty articulated theological, you know, perspective.
Yeah, and the so-called landmark dimension, especially appealing to missionary Baptists, you talk about that a bit, this which is very strong in Arkansas.
Right, yeah. In fact, missionary Baptist as a branch of the Baptist faith had its origin here in Arkansas, and even now Northeast Texas and Arkansas are probably the nerve center of missionary Baptist churches, you know, nationwide.
Right. A lot of people reading this book might be surprised because there's not much anti-Catholic hysteria among Protestants, especially I think a lot of people think, well, they grew to be in league because of their common opposition to abortion, and there's a lot of problems with that idea. But I think this word "imagine," I want to talk about that because you really are talking about, even despite the intellectual prowess of Bogart and other leaders, there is a certain non-logical mm-hmm. basis to this. Can you talk about that a little
yeah, bit? Yeah, I sort of didn't really directly answer your question about imagine before, and it is in my title, but I truly think that the gist of anti-Catholicism was created without direct knowledge of Catholics. You know, most people who were most anti-Catholic didn't have personal relationships with Catholics. I would say my parents, I would include them in that, that if they ever had had a meaningful relationship with a Roman Catholic, they would have perhaps felt differently than they did. And I found even a pattern of that when looking at things like the roll call voting pattern in the convent inspection bill, that I could see that people tended to vote for that kind of anti-Catholic legislation in parts of Arkansas where there weren't any Catholics. But in the areas of the state where people had Catholic neighbors, they knew them, the representatives from those areas like Johnson County, Pulaski County, Jefferson County, Sebastian County tended to vote against that anti-Catholic legislation. So I think like with prejudice in general, ignorance or lack of knowledge and experience, personal experience, is mm-hmm. one of the things that, that fuels, you know, that sort of prejudice.
Yeah. I'm talking with Kenneth C. Barnes, Ken Barnes, who's won the 2017 Booker Worthen Prize for Anti-Catholicism in Arkansas, his book, which was published by the University of Arkansas Press. And if you, at the risk of geeking out for a minute, it's an occupational hazard of talking to historians. The sources, the, mm-hmm. the material you had to base this research on, I will admit to being a reader of footnotes. Mm-hmm. I'm not proud of it. But the specific member, let's talk for a second about Klan, the specific members of Klan organizations, there is, you can find out who a lot of these people are.
Well, generally no, but we actually have two specific lists of Klan chapters in Arkansas. One was for Monticello, mm-hmm. and several years ago, a professor down there, Don Holly, wrote a really fine article about unmasking the Klan, was able to, you know, basically say who these people were, and they were the community leaders of Monticello. And in the process of doing my work for this book, on the two chapters where I deal with the Klan, I found a list, similar list, for the Bentonville, Arkansas Klan, number 69. And there were 162 names of men in Bentonville who were part of the Klan. And after I finished the book, I've written an article that's going to come out in November in the next issue of the Arkansas Historical Quarterly, looking at who these people were. And what I found is in the opposite corner of Arkansas from Monticello in northwest Arkansas, it was pretty much the same story. It was the physicians, the clergy, the lawyers, the county officials, the teachers, businessmen on the courthouse square, you know, downtown Bentonville, were the men who by and large were the members of the Klan there, and then also some of the prosperous farmers, more so than laborers or craftsmen or blue-collar folks.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to suggest we know all of them everywhere, mm-hmm. but there, it is possible to know who some of these people mm-hmm. are. And it, also the fact that it was not just a Southern right. phenomenon. For
Certainly.
A while, the mm-hmm. national head of it was a dentist from Indiana and mm-hmm. so on. But I'm still fascinated by the and curious about what animated this, the need for an enemy, even one that was largely unknown.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that was so important to those folks?
I think the early 1900s, there was just like a convergence of fears or paranoia. I mean, it's a time following massive immigration to the United States from mostly places that were different where people were coming from earlier, people coming from Italy, Eastern Europe, lots of Jews and lots of Catholics. It seemed to be, to many Americans, to change the complexion of who Americans really are. And then at the same time, we've got, as you said, modernism, science and evolution, and all kinds of ideas that are challenging traditional values. You know, even though Prohibition was successful, it was flaunted, you know, so in the face of people, conservative, you know, people that the 20s were just a time when things came together. For some people thought it's time to take a stand for keeping traditions, and traditions in terms of values and traditions in terms of who people are. Even though most of those immigrants weren't coming to Arkansas, there was still a real sense of defining who Americans should be and what our institutions are and what our core values should be, and take a stand here in Arkansas and other places in the South and the Midwest especially about it.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit about Joe Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
You speak a bit about his running with Al Smith, and talk about that campaign and,
right.
and his notoriety to a certain extent that,
right.
that generated.
Yeah, 1928 was the first year that a Roman Catholic actually got the nomination from either of the important parties for the presidency of the United States, and that was a big deal in this climate of the 1920s. And Al Smith, the governor of New York, that sort of symbolized everything that these Klansmen or traditional Southerners would love to hate, was Al Smith there. And he very wisely chose a candidate as his vice presidential running mate who would balance the ticket nicely. So he chose a Methodist senator from Arkansas who had actually opposed prohibition nationally, though he was known to enjoy a good whiskey now and then in secret, to balance the ticket, you know, with this New Yorker who's a Roman Catholic and taking a pro-liquor stance in the election.
Yeah. But Robinson got some criticism for running with this
certainly
wet Catholic.
It really whipped up interest in that 1928 election in Arkansas, I think, from various directions to have a native son on the ticket. But, you know, so many conservatives in Arkansas thought that Robinson had sold out, you know, to the mm-hmm. party and to these mm-hmm. other interests. And in the end, it was a minority who felt that way because the Democratic Party did carry Arkansas in 1928.
Yeah. And it certainly didn't end, even though Smith lost, it didn't end Taylor Robinson's.
Yeah, that was a prediction. People were saying in Arkansas, oh, it's ending his career. He'll never be reelected. But just the contrary, his stock really rose in the 1930s when he became Senate Majority Leader under Franklin Roosevelt.
Talk for a bit about the post-World War II period. Mm-hmm. Or in fact, you might want to back up and talk about the effects of the Depression, too, on this. But the teens and 20s were pretty different from the 30s and 40s.
They certainly were. Yeah. In fact, I thought that I would end my book in 1928, that would be a bookend for it. But because there really wasn't a lot of public expression of anti-Catholicism in the 30s and the 40s and the early 1950s like there had been in the teens and in the 1920s. Although I suspect it was, of course, still there, more in private, circulating in private conversations or maybe from pulpits and churches and so forth. It just wasn't organized as a movement like it had been in the teens and the 20s. But, of course, that comes an end in 1960 when we again have a presidential candidate who's Roman Catholic, mm-hmm. you know, John F. Kennedy.
And you cut it off in that year.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because that was a better bookend?
Well, I thought I was just going to have a little epilogue that brought up the Kennedy election in 1960, but when I started digging into it, I found there was more there to talk about. So it ended up being a chapter of its own, and some of the same old stuff was said in 1960 that had been said in the 1920s and the 28 election. Mostly it's a different cast of characters in 1960, but there are a few people who were there in 28 who still are around to have something to say in 1960. So some of it was the same. But when the Kennedy election, this time, of course, he wins, the Catholic candidate wins, but it really does burst the bubble in a big way of anti-Catholicism, because it turned out to be not much of a big deal to have a Catholic president, and he didn't really seem to transgress and let his religion trump his American loyalties or whatnot. So a lot of the stuff that they had been saying about Al Smith or Kennedy, you know, becoming president, just didn't turn out to be true in those 3 years that he was president.
Yeah. And Kennedy was very conscious of needing not to seem foreign.
Very much.
And
yes.
He was a war hero. He had a lot of kind of typical American virtues, mm-hmm. and people kept quiet about the the things that weren't virtuous. Huh. But why do you think he did a better job of overcoming that than Smith was able to do?
Good question. I think he had the historical experience mm-hmm. to work from, and he knew what had happened in 1928. He set up his campaign to address the issue of religion head-on early in the campaign, very effectively. He made a speech in Houston about his faith that was probably the best speech. Many of the commentators of the time said it might have been his best showing other than his famous debate with Nixon, when he came out really looking to a nationwide audience, very positive. So I think he planned it well. And I think he was just very meticulous about drawing a line. And then after he became president, not trespassing across a line where he would play to his religious values, and was just very careful to be a secular American president, rather than one that could be accused of letting his religious beliefs color his political actions. Yeah.
Taking orders from the Pope.
Right, exactly.
People were afraid what happened. The Klan really reemerges in some ways during the Civil Rights Movement. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that just for a little bit? That's
right.
Not really directed toward Catholics, but I think we need to wrap mm-hmm. that up.
Right, since a lot of people, when they hear about the Klan, they think immediately of the Klan of the Civil Rights Movement, the post-Civil Rights Movement, the Klan that still exists today. As far as I know, I'm not a real expert on this third Klan, but from what I know, there's not really an organizational connection to the second Klan, it's not so anti-Catholic, although you could, I think, find expressions, in the rhetoric of this Klan that is, but there have been other fish to fry, from this newer Klan, and certainly race has been front and center. But, nowadays, other issues like those kind of social mores issues of gay marriage and secular humanism and different kinds of things have become a big part of, what they have to talk about.
Yeah. Are there, you've talked a bit about this, are there legacies of what you talk about in this book that we're dealing with today that color, pardon the pun, our understandings of what's going on?
Well, I think for me, studying about prejudice became really more relevant at about the time that my book was being finished up and coming out, that we seem to be having more and more conversations about some of the very same issues, not so much with Catholics as the subject as other ethnic groups, maybe Muslims or Latinos or undocumented workers and so forth, that it just seems to be a continuing conversation that we've had from the very beginning of our history as Americans, issue of discussing who is really an American or an authentic American, who might not be, and just over time, different groups of people have been defined as the one that's the other that may not be as authentic as the majority, and I think the conversation continues.
Yeah, the nativism revisited, yeah. Mm. Anything you want to add before we stop? You've done a great job describing your award-winning book.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been fun to talk about it.
Well, Central Arkansas Library System is proud to be associated with the Worthen Prize and proud to have Kenneth Barnes, who's the 2017 winner for his book, Anti-Catholicism in Arkansas. Thanks.
Sure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Primary Sources on Radio CALS, a production of the Central Arkansas Library System, its Arkansas History Department, the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies, and the CALS Communications and Public Relations Department. For more information, please visit cals.org and butlercenter.org. Our producer is Glenn Whaley. Production manager is Shelley Stormo. Voices by Jasmine Job and John Miller. Engineering and editing by Anna Lancaster and Shelley Stormo. Our executive producers are Leanne Blackwell-Hoskin and David Strickland.